Welcome to the Interior Health Nursing Grand Rounds, a podcast conversation. I am your host, Allison Thomas, and on this podcast, we talk all things nursing and healthcare. I work as the clinical nurse specialist in the Trauma Services Network in Interior Health. Interior Health would like to recognize and acknowledge the traditional, ancestral, and unceded territories of the Dakal Dene, Tanaha, Inglekatma, Shawepam, Statliam, Sioux, and Chicoltean nations, where we live, learn, collaborate, and work together. I'm really excited to introduce to you today Tracy Scott. She's a real trailblazing nurse in our health region. And I'm actually going to ask Tracy just to introduce herself. And Tracy, tell us whatever you'd like us to know about you, personal or professional.
Oh, perfect. Thank you so much. And thank you for having me and providing this platform, Allie. First of all, I'll say most importantly, I am a mom and a grandma of two granddaughters. So that is and a wife and a family member. And so thanks for allowing me to talk a little bit more about that part, my most important part of my life, I would say, along with myself. So I am a clinical nurse specialist for child maltreatment and sexual violence. It's a new position in the CNS world in Canada, actually, where there's a divided portfolio between child maltreatment and sexual violence. And I actually put together my own proposal for this role, noticing a gap and a need, and to highlight the magnitude of child maltreatment and sexual violence and resources, et cetera, around this area. So I finally got officially awarded that position by Interior Health in December of 2022. So again, new role that I'm still trying to develop and based on needs and gaps identified. So do you want me to break down a little bit about the role currently on both sides?
Sure, that would be great. Yeah, it sounds a bit, it sounds like incredibly important work. And it also sounds like it takes a very special person to do this type of work. Could you tell us a little bit, what is the day-to-day work that you do and what does your job look like in that way?
Yeah, sure. So it really just takes somebody that, like yourself, sees a need and a gap and is an advocate for, in my mind, it's those that have crimes against children and youth. And my background around that was I've been a registered nurse since 1989. I've worked for Interior Health that whole time. And predominantly my career background was on pediatrics. And then back in 2003, Interior Health had a new clinic that was coming to us called the Suspected Child Abuse and Neglect Clinic. It's a regional program. There's actually five in BC. Mm-hmm. And I was working PEDS at the time, and it was a clinic that was going to be a regional program that did all medical evaluations, medical legal evaluations on children that experienced maltreatment. And it was going to be located at Royal Inland Hospital in Kamloops. And so my manager brought that concept to me, and I applied for the position. And that's where my career started in child maltreatment back in 2003. And so within that time, did probably up to at least 1,000 or more exams with a pediatrician or pediatricians as part of a team with psychologist and social worker and coordinator and admin, and then at the time, pediatricians and a gynecologist. And we all had to become experts in child maltreatment and sexual violence. So I had zero training or background. So I spent years educating myself and taking as many courses and getting as many certificates I could in child maltreatment and sexual assault, just so I had a really healthy understanding of what that work meant and looked like. So I worked there for just over 10 years. And at that time, when I was at the clinic, I actually just felt a need and a gap in some of the care as far as longitudinal health for these children, mitigating further adverse outcomes for these children, and also that holistic sort of approach. So after they left the clinic, you know, what was sort of next steps? And so I also noticed a big gap in education awareness of child maltreatment because I didn't know anything, and I'd worked PEDS. I thought, well, at least particularly us as PEDS nurses should have a bit more education and understanding. We certainly don't get that in our formal training as nurses, as our registered nurses, or not a lot of education. And so I actually went first, I actually graduated with a diploma. We didn't have a BSN at the time at what was then Caribou College. So I went back to TRU and got my degree, and then back again to get my master's. And my master's, I did a focus on child maltreatment and sexual violence. And subsequent to that, put a proposal into Interior Health for this role so that I could have put a voice and advocacy and start to develop protocols, et cetera, provide leadership, research, clinical, all those things that we do as a CNS in this realm. So I was very blessed to be awarded. That took 7 years to get that through. But again, it's the first in Canada. So I give lots of kudos to Interior Health for really seeing this as a need and putting one role, although they did identify that this most likely, I think it was Donna Mandel that said, oh my gosh, we need about 10 people in this role to do this work. And I really appreciated based on the magnitude of the work that and those impacted that I agree. And now that I'm in the work, I agree. basically as part of my education, I'm a forensic nurse examiner. And I also did my sexual assault nurse examiner courses for adolescent and adults so that I could do also the acute evidentiary exam for sexual assaults across the lifespan. So that's sort of my background. My portfolio was child maltreatment and sexual violence. So on the sexual violence piece, just so the audience is aware, I sit on the Ministry of Health working group where we developed what's called SAFE, so sexual assault forensic examination policy and guidelines for the province on how we were going to standardize sexual assault care in the acute care setting, so in our emerge departments. And so I was grateful to be part of that working group that developed that, and that policy and guideline is coming out shortly. Subsequent to that, I was able to come back to Interior Health and let them know that this policy was coming and that we really needed to look at our gaps and implement a program with infrastructure, etc., to meet these ministry guidelines and policy. And so that was successful. And again, we've been trying to put this program in for about 12 years. So I was really excited that the Ministry of Health came out with that thou shalt, and Interior Health got right on board with Heather Harris, our ESM director at that time. I guess currently she's gone off on a secondment, but so myself and Kathleen Nicholson and Lisa Hovenshield are the three that are developing and implementing a SAFE program for Interior Health. And so we actually, resource wise, and I'll come back to resource too, but we have a sexual assault toolkit on the inside net. I'm going to be developing more. I have some there on child sexual abuse. So that's another resource along with my child maltreatment toolkit, which I've also developed, and I'll circle back to that. On the sexual assault side, I also support current sexual assault examiners, provide training and skill sessions. I'm a consultant. I'm not able to do on call at this time for adolescent adults just because of the job, but I certainly do a lot of consulting and educating and working with the team and developing and implementing the program that will be fulsome within 2024 by the end of that. That's that part. So I also am developing guidelines for emergency departments on conducting the child sexual abuse exams for those that don't have experts in their community and can consult with the SCAN clinic or our experts in sexual assault. And then on the child maltreatment role, I'll speak to just a few things. So I currently, to keep competent, I actually now in my CNS role for my clinical piece of my job, I actually conduct child maltreatment exams at the regional SCAN clinic that I spoke of. So once a month, I do one or two child sexual abuse exams for non-acute, and then can be available for acute evidentiary exams as well. So that's been great. And I work very collaboratively with law enforcement and child protection in those cases. And within those cases, I'm needing to create and offer a medical opinion based on history, et cetera, et cetera. So that is what I'm doing to keep my competency up clinically. I'm also, for the audience that may not know, I'm a huge advocate for best practice, which I think in child maltreatment is a coordinated response to child abuse. So we have what's called child and youth advocacy centers throughout the Interior Health. I'm actually a co-founder of our Big Bear Child and Youth Advocacy Center that's located in Kamloops. And a small part of my FTE is actually attached in partnership with Interior Health to Big Bear CYC. So I work out of there as well. And within that role, I actually what I call triage all new investigations throughout the region, and specifically Kamloops and some of those. Where when there's a new case that comes through from child protection or law enforcement or health, I bring whoever's directly involved and we have an opportunity to share information, to coordinate care, to streamline services, to make sure everybody has a piece of the puzzle. And that's one of the biggest things with child maltreatment, is that often one agency has a piece of the puzzle and the other agency doesn't. And when we put all the pieces of the puzzle together, we really get a really great, better understanding. So it's very important in child maltreatment. It's very unique for health to work in isolation. And so majority of my day is spent collaborating with law enforcement or child protection. So I think that's one of the biggest differences in this role as a CNS, is I really work very collaboratively with multi-agencies in the work. And that is best practice and yields the best outcome for the children and youth we serve, longitudinal health-wise, and also for potentially the judicial system and outcomes there. So yeah, I conduct those triages there. Again, the child and youth advocacies really are like I said, they're collaborative services designed to provide a coordinated response to child abuse and crimes against children and youth. And it's very trauma-informed, culturally safe, and child-friendly environment. So they're centers that are outside the hospital. And currently in the health authority, we've got the Big Bear, like I said, in Kamloops. We've got the Oak Center, Oak CYC in Vernon, the CAC of Kelowna, and the Sky Response in the Kootenays area. And Sam and Arma is actually just doing their feasibility study and getting that started. One of the big things I'm really excited about, some of the project work I've been doing, is provincially and nationally, I'm doing some work around offering virtual care, virtual health, if you will, for child maltreatment, because as you know, our geography in interior health is very spread. And so children, our youth and families are really wanting to be better served in their own communities and not have to travel to the scan clinic, and wanting to be served within their CYC in their own communities. And so doing lots of research and lots of work on how we can provide as experts, virtual telehealth, if you will, to a healthcare provider in another community. So they do this and utilize this already in New York. And so I'm really doing a lot of work on seeing how we can implement that. And we're also doing that actually for our sexual assault work as well, for adolescent adults, is virtualizing what we're calling telesane or telesafe. And that will be coming out in the near future as well. So I'm really, really excited about doing that. I do a lot of actually national and provincial work, because I really believe that standard of care is standard care for children and youth, and that really needs to just, and then I can bring that information back to our health authorities and better serve that larger population, if you will. And I'm a huge proponent for equitable access and services for all children that have been impacted by violence of some form. So within my role, some of the things I've sort of been working on is, one thing you'll be familiar with is the duty report policy for suspected child abuse and neglect. And we can talk a little bit more about that at the end, which is probably helpful for our listeners. I'm looking at working with child protection around what we're calling or terming taking children into care. So that we used to know that as child apprehensions or removals, if you will. So taking children into care in a safe and trauma-informed way within an acute care setting. So I know we can do better in that area. So I'm going to I've been started some work around that. Looking at a physical abuse screening tool for emergency departments and we'll talk more about that as well. Telehealth, which I spoke of, I'm part of a group, or the co-chair of creating national standards for child sexual abuse. I just did some work on the pediatric emergency nurses assessment record to incorporate child maltreatment lens, and looking at other differential diagnoses, if you will, other than what most emergency room physicians and staff and nurses are used to looking for. I just led a working group that we just developed some education on child maltreatment and all the different forms for BC Crown prosecutors, which has been great. And also working on a partnership agreement with BC coroners and RCMP on involving scan clinic in child death reviews, which unfortunately we do experience in our region. Just more guidelines and protocols on sexual assault in general, and child sexual abuse and child physical abuse for in the acute care settings. So lots of work to do, lots more
just
work
one
to
or,
do.
One or two things that you're working
just,
on, hey, just Tracy?
Two things I'm working. Yeah, exactly. So again, I need a whole team, but I'm just so grateful, like I said to you, Allison, for this opportunity to heighten and get the word out that, yeah, this is it is a current issue. And I'll talk a little bit more about stats. Or maybe I'll just kind of quickly go into that. Maybe that's helpful just to have you understand a little bit more about stats. So according to Statistics Canada, child abuse in Canada is estimated to be close to 36%, which translates to approximately one in three children who have likely experienced abuse. So physical abuse, sexual abuse, emotional abuse, neglect. And if we equate that, I looked at a 2017 stats for number of children we had in Interior Health at that time. So it was 133,000 children in Interior Health. So if you look at approximately 30% of kids in Interior Health are impacted, that's approximately 47,000 children impacted by some form of child maltreatment. So it is a big issue that we have in our own health authority. If we look at the statistics, the challenge is that we know there's a high probability out there and or prevalence, sorry, and we're only seeing, you know, sometimes up to 110 kids at our scan clinic a year. Mm-hmm. So there's a big gap, and one of the big gaps is awareness, and that's the hope of today, is to add a little bit more awareness. But there's also lots around us not recognizing, or children not recognizing even that they're abused, and they're not disclosing, not reporting. And also when they're coming into healthcare, we need to develop a better data collection tool so we can actually get better statistics around the data and amount of children that are accessing services. What we know is that these children do come into eMERGE, but they're often not recognized even in our stats. So they may, for example, come in with what looks like a fractured clavicle, for example. And so that's what we have for our stats and data, this fractured clavicle. But on discharge, we found that it was a non-accidental trauma, and that's not recorded. So those are just an example of how we need to, and that's part of my role, is helping to define better ways of capturing data around those sort of things. What we also know is there's a higher proportion of Indigenous peoples that self-reported experiencing some form of childhood physical and or sexual maltreatment before the age of 15 compared to non-Indigenous counterparts. So it was a 40% and 29% respectively. So they are definitely overrepresented there, Indigenous people, and so really highlighting that as well. Underreporting was a big issue, particularly especially during COVID-19 pandemic, meaning the scale of the issue is much larger than these numbers shown above. And we really know that childhood exploitation, for example, was really heightened during that time. There was lots of children homes where domestic violence rates went through the roof and children were exposed to domestic violence. And now we're recognizing that children that witness domestic violence is also one form of child maltreatment, and the implications to particularly mental health is a huge concern, and can also be a physical risk for them as well. There's also a growing body of research on the short and long-term physical, emotional, and social impacts of child abuse and violence on children. For example, in Canada, 1 in 10 adults who are abused as children will report having a mental health issue or limitation. 1 in 7 adults before the age of 15 report having been homeless. Illegal drug use is twice as common in adults who have experienced abuse as children. So we really do know that childhood trauma and childhood maltreatment can lead to adverse childhood experiences, but can lead to adverse events such as, like you say, we just homelessness, drug use, gang violence, mental health concerns and issues, and a whole bunch of other things that really the idea for us in my work is to provide not prevention, early intervention to mitigate all those risks, which is what's so exciting about the work we're doing, especially with these CYCs. And that's the whole goal of the CYCs, is early intervention. So the other thing I always just sort of put some cost to it as healthcare providers is that in Canada, the total cost of child abuse on Canada's society was estimated to be $23 billion in 2018. So for comparison, this is up to four times greater than the estimated annual direct and indirect costs associated with obesity, estimated to be only 5.2 to 8.4 billion in 2017 dollars, and is roughly equivalent to the costs associated with tobacco use. So there is a huge amount of money that is equated to healthcare for the cost of child maltreatment. And that's, again, why I advocate for early intervention as well. And if you looked at a cost place that that really is costly to our health authority, and we really look at, you know, as healthcare providers, there's more and more education coming around ACE, so adverse childhood experiences, and really looking at those things that we're dealing with at the front door here. When we really peel back the onion, it's very common to see that child maltreatment and abuse is sort of at the root cause of a lot of those things that we're dealing with. So we really do, as healthcare providers, need to be peeling back the onion when we're doing assessments and when we're asking questions and gathering history to see what else could have been causes for these things that brought them, the presenting issue, if you will, that brought them into healthcare and have compromised their health. I just think that it's important to start looking outside the box for other reasons and root causes is sort of, I guess, my message there. So if you want, I can just lean a little bit more into just some of the things that I was hoping the audience would just be thinking of when they're seeing kids or youth come into the department that might be potential risk factors or even red flags. So just things to be thinking of when you're doing your assessments or you're dealing with children and family. And I always say, particularly eMERGE nurses, really, you know, you're the finger on the pulse of these children and youth. You have an opportunity when kids come into healthcare to have a really good look at their bodies, even if they're coming in for, you know, say a hand injury or another unrelated, like you're the eyes, you're a safe place. We're known as that. We hear what's going on. We see the interactions of the family. If things are sort of, I will say, making your hair stand or something's just not fitting right for you or your spidey sense is going off, it's really, that intuition is really, really, really important to listen to and to follow that up and be thinking outside the box again, saying, well, you know, what else could be happening here? This just isn't sitting for me. And so one of the things we sort of look for is, if there's an injury, is looking at, was there a delay in seeking medical care? That's one of the biggest things too, is, okay, getting a good history. When did this injury happen? What events led you to coming to the hospital? And so just getting more of a history. So you're not in an accusatory way, but just really trying to understand what was it. Was there a delay? Were they appropriate? You know, mom said the child fell off the swing, had pain, brought them to the hospital. That's a normal, if you will, response. But if there's things that are outside of that, it's important just to pay attention to. Now, these things in isolation aren't necessarily a risk factor or concern, but there's something when the picture comes together to just be thinking of. So in isolation, just to me means I need to get more history and I need to understand a bit more, or I need to ask a few more questions, or I need to get a few more people involved. So delay in seeking medical attention, no history or very inconsistent history. So the child has an injury and that they're really not able to provide a good history. So that injury matches the history, sort of what we're looking for. If it makes sense to your brain, probably it makes a bit more sense. Mm-hmm. If there's changing stories, so one not really clear in the history, but they're sort of giving maybes and or the other partners giving a very different story. Again, just to pay attention to those kind of things and to raising your concerns a little bit like that. The other thing would be the changing history that I was saying. Unwitnessed injury is another thing to be paying attention, really grabbing. There's just cues to get more, ask more questions, to get more history. Asking the parent if they have any concerns is a really good thing. Is there domestic violence in the home? And that's a sensitive question, but if you get the sense of or you hear of anything like that, that's certainly something to be paying attention to. The kids are at more harm and risk of, and that's a reportable offense at this point. Premature babies, we know in research can be at higher risk. And again, in itself is not an issue, absolutely not. I'd never want that message, but it's just if you hear other things going along with that, there's can be more risk factors for premature infants under 37 weeks. Premature or low birth weights is another thing. When we're looking sort of at that, neglect, which is a bigger topic in itself, and one of the most it's our highest reportable offense, is our highest incidence of child maltreatment is neglect. And I think we need a lot more education on how to sort of pick up on neglect. It's a really hard thing to diagnose as well. If the child in the past has been referred to a scan clinic, or there has been some documentation of any suspected child abuse in the past, that would be another sort of red flag. And if a child or youth describes any pressure being applied to the neck at any sort, and that's not a question. We talk about strangulation. Kids don't know what strangulation means. And so we really try to offer that differently. Was any pressure ever applied to your neck, your chest, or your mouth that would ever have impeded, or however you'd use that in child language, right, that from taking a big breath, or, and really, you know, looking at other things like their sclera, looking for any petechiae, looking at their mouths, all those kind of things, which we'll talk a bit more about examination findings. But certainly pressure on the neck is a new term we're sort of applying and using as a question, and particularly in sexual assault, there's a high correlation between sexual assault, even with children, and strangulation, if you will, a pressure. So just wanting to, I think that's good for our ICU nurses information as well. And then some other risk factors when you're actually doing exams, and maybe part of as a nurse or a physician, is any injury to an infant who's not yet mobile. That is a really, really important thing. And that's why with all infants, we want nurses to get their eyes on all parts of their body, no matter what. One bruise in isolation on a non-mobile child may not seem like a big red flag for us. It's absolutely a huge indicator that requires further investigation. They don't, unless there's a really good, tangible idea of what happened, and none of these other risk factors come into it. But at the same time, that's, I would always reach out in consultation with one of our experts to inquire more about a bruise on a non-mobile child. And so,
Tracy, I have very limited pediatric experience, but I think the only thing that I knew about child maltreatment before I got to know you a little bit more was, if they're too young to cruise, they're too young to bruise. Is that still
absolutely
right?
Okay. Correct. Yeah. That's what I'm saying. So you have an infant that's not crawling or moving. Yeah. So any we could say infant typically that's not moving should not be having a bruise ever. And we really actually have had a few cases, more than a few cases, where when we did further diagnoses, we were actually to find 8 other injuries. So it's really important, if you ever see a bruise on a non-mobile child, to be escalating that concern as a nurse, for sure. Yeah, thank you for that. And the other thing is, if a child, so not even necessarily an infant, has unexplained bruises or injuries that is not making sense to you. That's, as I said earlier, injuries that have a pattern. So a pattern could be what looks like a handprint or an object or something that just isn't, bruises in areas where we don't expect to see bruising on a child who's even very mobile. So the torso is a huge area that, or I guess anywhere that covers their bathing suit, we would not expect to see bruises. Ears and neck. Ears are a particular big red flag for us. And if they're less than 4 years old, that we call that 10, so TEN-4, that's our 10-4 rule. Bruises on different and various stages of healing. We can't date bruise and say whatever, but that's really important information if we have, and should be a red flag for us. Burns on hands, feet, and are a particular concern, and genitalia, sorry, that's the other part too. So we look at immersion burns and those sorts of things. So again, children spill things on themselves all the time. They unfortunately come in with burns, but if you have sort of pattern burns and you have burns that don't sort of fit with the normal, or like burns that are sort of linear coming to this, so the top of the hand or immersion, what looks like burns, that's certainly, again, not in isolation, but warrants more an escalation and more history gathered. A torn frenulum, that is not something as nurses we typically, nor did I as a pediatric nurse, ever look into a child's mouth, particularly bottle feeding baby or young children's. But there's actually, in the research, quite a few injuries from sort of more violent feeding and frustration with the child. And we really do need to look in the children's mouth. for torn frenulums, for petechiae on the in the mouth, or anything like that, any oral injuries as part of our head to toe. And again, me as a nurse, that's certainly not something I was typically doing, mm-hmm. but I would really encourage you guys to take a look when you're doing your head to toe assessment. Any fractures in a non ambulating infant or child, sorry, or any fractures in an infant, any fractures that don't make sense in a child. Rib fractures are a particular concern for us. Posterior, particularly in the infants. Undiagnosed healing fractures is another great thing. Genital bruising, bleeding, or injury, which can be explained. We've got kids with that fall off their bike or onto the mm-hmm. and have straddle injuries and all different things, but certainly that's a reason again for us to look further and ask a few more questions. And then head injuries, of course, on children and youth, and bleeding to the brain, that's a huge risk factor. So again, this is just some of those things that I would just want people to be heightened to, if these are some of the things that they're gathering their history or seeing within their exam. So I guess probably they just some really things sort of takeaways, sort of really points that if I haven't sort of captured them already, is just being aware of the risk factor. I think that's one of the number one thing we can do as staff, is be more aware. Mm-hmm. To get curious is another thing, and just be thinking non-accidental trauma or differential diagnosis is when we're looking at some of these things. What is really important for you to know, and we'll go back to resources, is that for child sexual abuse, if there's a concern, often RCMP will bring these kids in, or MCFD will bring the kids in, and that we do have on the InsideNet in the sexual assault toolkit, also in the child maltreatment toolkit, a guideline for the emergency department on those less than 13, so prepubescent, that have a report or presentation of child sexual abuse or assault. So there's some there direction there, so I won't go in there, but essentially, you know, children are best served not in the emergency department. And so if we are able to differentiate whether something's emergent or not, and it needs to be emergent, obviously it needs to be dealt with an emerge, but if not, it can be referred to the scan clinic, which I'll talk about in a minute. Like I said earlier, pay attention to your intuition. Always escalate your concerns to the most responsible physician, wherever that is, or your ERP, pediatrician, and document injuries. That is a huge thing for us at the scan clinic, is that we'll get a referral from eMERGE about a child with injuries or bruising, and then by the time we see them, because we're non-acute, mm-hmm. those injuries are gone and we cannot speak to them. So please on trauma gums, whatever you do, give us as much details, draw the injuries, measure the injuries. If RCMP are already involved, you know, you can call them and ask them if they can take non-genital photos of those injuries, but just any way you can give us as much details of the injuries, that's really important. That is one thing that we see time and time again, is our emerge departments are not documenting injuries, and that is a big takeaway for me for you guys today. The idea in the questions when I'm talking about gathering history, the idea is not to do what we call a forensic interview, so you're not asking. Once you sort of get a sense that something might not be sitting or it's a risk factor, it's really important to gather a really good history. If child protection, law enforcement in there, it's really best to ask law enforcement or child protection some of your questions, so you're not asking questions or take the guardian away from the child to ask them a question. You don't want to be asking questions if you're concerned about the child. Mm-hmm. You don't want to be asking those questions in front of the child. And so, yeah, getting as much information you can from the most appropriate person, I guess, is the part. That being said, if a child is verbal and a little older and they have an owie, if you will, or a fracture, you can ask them, absolutely, tell me what happened. And I think that's the key, is asking open-ended questions. Tell me what happened. Oh, I hurt my hand. Tell me more about that. So you can just really get, and they may tell you exactly what happened. And at that point, you would just document what they said in quotes, and then make sure you sort of stop and not ask any further questions. And of course, report that to the Ministry of Children and Family.
Great. Thanks, Tracy. We'll be back next time to continue the conversation more about duty to report. Please join us so we can continue learning from this wonderful expert nurse in our region. See you then. That's all for this episode. Thank you for joining us today. We know you're busy and your time is valuable. Thank you for spending some of it with us. Thank you for your commitment to your profession and to your patients, and being a part of the journey of building a culture of excellence around nursing in our health region.